Three of them will be heard this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Ellis County State Bank and Others versus Lynn Keever from Dallas County. Hess Selenese Corporation and Others versus the Honorable Eugene Chambers Action, an original mandamus proceeding. And Monsanto Company and Others versus Cornerstones Municipal Utility District from Harris County. In each of these three causes, the court has allowed 20 minutes for petitioners and respondents to present arguments. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and we'll complete these arguments before our lunch break. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make an application with the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioners in Ellis County State Bank and Others versus Keever.
May I please support Mr. Brent Cooper will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The key issue as we see it in this case is whether or not this court is going to continue to encourage the citizens of this state to report crimes by providing them with an enhanced protection through an enhanced burden of proof in malicious prosecution cases. Now, the Court of Appeals in this case held that under Texas law there was only one standard of proof to be submitted in civil cases, and that was the preponderance of the evidence. The court basically said that with respect to the clear and convincing evidence language that's contained in many cases, that it relates neither to the burden of proof that's placed upon the plaintiff, nor to the standard of review that this court or the trial court in reviewing the evidence is to engage in.
In other words, the Court of Appeals said that the standard of proof here is the same as in any other civil case.
The Court of Appeals said that the standard of proof, well, when you say any other civil cases, we believe there are civil cases out there where this court has said the standard of proof is clear and convincing, but the Court of Appeals held the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. Correct.
There are, of course, other cases in the malicious prosecution area that have reference terms like clear and convincing or clear and satisfactory. Can you point us to any decision of any appellate court that has ever reversed a trial court for using a preponderance of the evidence standard in a jury charge?
There is no case that has reversed a trial court. There is a case that has held it was error, but the error was not preserved. And that was the recent case that was just decided. The motion for rehearing was overruled in February of this year out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals called Browning Ferris Industries versus Leek, L-I-E-C-K, which is found in, at 845 Southwest 2nd, 926. In that case, the jury was charged upon a preponderance of the evidence. And the court held that, moreover, this case was submitted to the jury without objection under the preponderance of the evidence standard. This error became law of the case basically because the defendant in that case failed to object to the erroneous submission.
With the exception of that case, no other case in Texas history has ever, reported case, has ever reversed a trial court for submitting a malicious prosecution action on a preponderance of the evidence standard, has it?
There has been no reversals, that is correct.
And in fact, there has been one reversal of a trial court for failing to submit on a preponderance of the evidence theory, has there not?
Under the malicious prosecution?
Yes.
Standard, I don't recall that case, if there is. I think if we go back into the history under Texas jurisprudence, as far as malicious prosecution cases are concerned, there is confusion. As far back as 1949 in the Kirkland versus Montgomery Ward case, there is language. And again, it wasn't a reversal, but if you look at the language of that case, they talk about that the burden of proof was upon the appellee, the plaintiff in that case, to show by positive, clear, and convincing proof that there was no probable cause on the part of the defendant to commence the criminal action.
Isn't that essentially the same kind of admonition that Chief Justice Phillips referred to on behalf of this court recently in Rhodes against Cahill?
That is in the footnote in Rhodes versus Cahill. That, of course, was an adverse possession case, I believe, as opposed to malicious prosecution.
But now, you had the same kind of admonition, which he describes where the court is being simply an admonition to the trial judge to do his job or her job.
That is correct. This is also the admonition that was contained in State versus Turner and in State versus Addington dealing with involuntary commitments. And I'm sure, as this court's aware, that case was appealed up to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court said, you know, this is more than just a method about which the court views the evidence. When there are certain key societal interests at stake, in this case, involuntary commitment, we are going to require a greater threshold than a preponderance of the evidence. In fact, we're going to require, you know, maybe not beyond a reasonable doubt, but at least clear and convincing. And
what party who is being sued doesn't claim that there are greater societal interests involved or constitutional interests involved due to the taking clause? I mean, how are we going to draw this line if we make a firm declaration that malicious prosecution suits are subject to an enhanced burden of proof?
Well, obviously it's got to be done on a case-by-case basis, as this court has done. In fact, there are several other areas where this court has established a clear and convincing burden of proof for the plaintiff or for the state, depending upon who is the person who is going forward with the evidence. Establishing non-paternity, it's got to be by a clear and convincing standard. Murdoch versus Murdoch, this court in Texas, 1991. The establishment of paternity in a wrongful death suit, that is, if someone is seeking to recover in a wrongful death suit and there's some question about the paternity, that must be convincing evidence. Brown versus Edwards transfer by this court in 1989. Involuntary terminations of parental rights, Richardson versus Green in 1984 by this court. Of course, involuntary commitments, this court after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Addington case, held that the clear and convincing standard was the standard adopted in Texas to apply in involuntary termination cases.
Except in circumstances where we have been mandated to do so by the United States Supreme Court, or where there is a statute that, in the case of Brown against Edwards transfer, we sought consistency with statutes. Are there any other circumstances except where we've been mandated where this court has abandoned the well-established preponderance of the evidence test?
In Bogart versus Summer, this case in this court in 1988, I believe, applied the standard to the rebutting the presumption of a gift. Also, there are several cases, and I don't know if there's any Supreme Court cases dealing with reformation of contracts, and those go back 30 or 40 years where they've applied a clear and convincing standard as opposed to a preponderance of the evidence. And
again, Bogart was a per curiam denial without any discussion. Other than Bogart, the reformation of contract cases, those are cited in your brief?
Correct. That's correct.
Mr. Cooper?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why aren't the societal concerns you're talking about protected simply by the elements constituting malicious prosecution, and I'm talking really, I think, specifically of probable cause. If you have to demonstrate a lack of probable cause, why isn't the nature of the elements that have to be established to maintain to have a judgment on malicious prosecution solving all the problems you're talking about, having an enhanced burden of proof?
The same argument could be made for involuntary commitments, for terminations and whatnot. You have certain elements that must be established. And the reason we have the enhanced burden of proof...
The probable cause is where a reasonable person could have made this, reached a conclusion. It seems to me that's a little bit different than an involuntary commitment where you're having to establish the mental condition of an individual, and which it seems to me the elements of probable cause itself is a different type of proof that's being sought than the factual condition of an individual.
Well, but still in an involuntary commitment case, you have the basic elements that must be shown. The only question is, to what degree must they be shown? And if you look at the Supreme Court's decision, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Addington case, they talk about the purposes behind the enhanced burden of proof. And basically they said there are two purposes behind. They said first is to instruct the fact finder concerning the degree of confidence our society thinks the fact finder should have in the correctness of the factual decisions. So that is, we're going to tell the jury that you must be very, very certain in your decision you know, not merely by a preponderance of the evidence, but a degree of certainty as far as your decision is concerned. Second is the allocation of the risk of error between the litigants as far as error. And the Attican Court says, with respect to civil cases, the ordinary preponderance of the evidence cases, typically it involves just an issue of money, and society really has very little interest in that. And as a result, the risk of error is basically borne equally by both sides. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, you have your criminal cases, where the degree of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. And in those cases, society bears most of the risk of error because of the desire to avoid incarcerating someone who is innocent. And what the court said with respect to the clear and convincing standard is that it represents those areas where there's a clear societal interest that's involved. In those cases, we're going to place additional risk of error upon the plaintiff. Now, the question is, I guess before this court, is there a public policy issue that it would involve, that's involved in this case, which would justify the enhanced protection of an enhanced burden of proof? And we would submit that the legislature in the state has already answered that question on several occasions. In fact, if you look at how our legislature has acted with respect to the reporting of crimes, and again, if you go through the Medina case and the Cisneros case and all the ones we've cited in our briefs, the primary public policy that's involved, in fact, Cisneros says, public policy requires that there be wide latitude in reporting facts to prosecuting authorities in order to expose crime, or in order that the exposure of crime be not discouraged. So it's the exposure of crime and reporting of crime that's encouraged as far as the public policy. Now, what has our legislature done? We see that on at least 8 or 10 instances, the legislature has enacted specific statutes to encourage citizens to report crimes. The child abuse statute, section 34.03 of the Family Code, confers immunity to people who report child abuse as far as liability from civil suits, because we want people to report to the authorities children who are being abused without the fear of being sued. We have
the legislature knows how to change the statutes to reflect public policy if it feels that's necessary.
The legislature has, obviously they know how to change the statutes, and they have, I'm sorry.
They've done that with regard to the burden of proof in some statutes, but they have not done that with reference to malicious prosecution.
Of course, malicious prosecution is a common law cause of action. There is no codification as far as the elements or whatever. And I assume the legislature has assumed that the case law has so well developed this area that there's been no need for the legislature to act. But you go on, the whistleblower statute, you have a privilege to investigate theft. You have recently the hazing statute, where you can report hazing and receive civil immunity. Abuse of the elderly under the health code, nursing homes where there's abuse in there.
Aren't each of those privileges overcome by a proof and finding of malice?
In some occasions they can be overcome by a finding of malice. That
which
is correct.
Which is an essential element of the malicious prosecution cause of action.
That is correct.
Why aren't the social policies that you want to advance preserved by the rigors of the malicious prosecution cause of action? In other words, it's pretty hard to win one, isn't it, from a plaintiff's point of view?
Well, if you look, I guess, over the last few years, since 1988, there's been quite a few that's been lost. Medina, Ortiz, the Browning-Ferris, there's a new one that came out last month out of Houston, involving, I believe, the telephone company. They're not apparently as easy to lose or easy to lose as one would think, because apparently the juries are having no problems, at least these cases that are being reported, in entering judgments or entering verdicts against the defendants for relatively large sums.
How do you reconcile what you say, the strong public interest that innocent people don't go to jail, with a corresponding public interest in reporting crime, whereas in this case, someone ends up in jail. Only 15 minutes, but he is booked, he's recorded, he's fingerprinted, he's put in jail. And how do you balance an innocent person's, we just don't want an innocent person to go through that, against someone reporting crime and saying we'd rather have them report crime than have someone not face those kind of 30-minute inconveniences.
The Medina Court addresses that, and basically what it says, I believe in like the fourth or fifth page of the opinion, it says we must accommodate, we must balance these interests. It says the way we accommodate these is, first off, we do want our citizens to report crimes. And the way we accommodate that interest is that we have the protections through all the rigors that are built into the malicious prosecution, including in that tort, the enhanced burden of proof. On the other hand, as far as protection for those who are charged with a crime, we have all the constitutional protections that are afforded. Granted, the criminal justice system is not perfect, and there are sometimes there are people who have to go through the trial before they're acquitted, and that's one of the, flaws in our criminal justice system, but it's one that we've accepted and that has become part of our system. But the Medina Court talks about the balancing of these two interests, and the way that they are accommodated is by having the constitutional protection for the criminal defendants, and then for the potential civil defendants, we have the enhanced burden of proof and all the other rigors that are built into the malicious prosecution action in order to continue to encourage our citizenry to report the crimes. Now, if you look at where we are today in our society, there is a problem. There is, a feeling that a lot of people, we don't want to get involved. And a lot of crimes are committed and they're not solved. And I think this court, in this decision, will be making a statement to those people about whether or not they ought to get involved or not, or whether or not they ought to sit back and not say anything. And we believe that there will be a message sent by the court, by the decision, regarding whether or not people should continue to report crimes. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Did the legislature, in enacting those provisions that you recited a while ago, where they imposed or granted immunity or some protection for whistleblowers from people reporting certain classes of crimes, and I presume you would agree that they had particular classes of crimes in mind when they did that. Did they not, when they protected people reporting those crimes, did they not address what otherwise would have been an ordinary burden of proof? Had there been a malicious prosecution in those cases? In other words, had they not acted and granted that type of immunity with the standard of proof for a malicious prosecution that Judge Cornyn alluded to be in existence, they could go ahead and proceed them
in the absence of
an ordinary civil proceeding, couldn't they?
In the absence of the specific statutes by the legislature, then the people who would have reported these crimes would have been subjected to the same malicious prosecution standard that applied someone who reports a murder or a theft or bank robbery, whatever.
Right. Same standard.
The same standard.
You're saying that that we should virtually grant the same standard here that the legislature has granted in those cases as far as the burden of proof is concerned.
What I'm saying is that with respect to malicious prosecution, whether it involves the reporting of a murder or child abuse or whatever, there is a basic Texas policy that exists to encourage people to report these crimes, and if we want to continue to with this public policy.
But does that policy exist here where you could argue just as well the other side of the coin that financial institution is attempting to utilize the criminal processes to help it recover a civil claim.
If in fact there has been abuse of the system, then I think even under the enhanced standard, the plaintiff will have no problem in proving their case. But, for example, and I guess the classic example, and I was thinking about this as I was getting ready, was the William Kennedy Smith rape case, where you just have two people, and it's a swearing match. And the question is, date rape, am I going to report it or not, because it's going to be my word against his, and if I lose, am I going to be subject to a civil lawsuit for all the attorney's fees and all the mental anguish that's been sustained by the person who was alleged to have committed
the crime? But you would still have the standards of malicious prosecution that Judge Cornyn discussed with you a while ago?
The standards would still be there, but again, the question is, to what degree must the plaintiff establish this?
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Wood will present argument from respondent.
Please support. I'm Robert Wood, and I represent Glenn Kiever, the respondent in this case, and cross-petitioner. This appeal actually encompasses three major areas for review: the burden of proof in malicious prosecution, the prejudgment interest on future damages and punitive damages, and the appellate review of the factual sufficiency of the evidence points. Each point has been thoroughly briefed. With the court's permission, I'll turn my attention to those points in that order. In order to reverse and remand in this case on the basis of the petitioner's request, this court would have to take six significant steps. First, it would have to overrule the only Texas case that has squarely faced and decided this issue. Secondly, it would have to disregard the admonition of this court a third of a century ago that no doctrine is more firmly established than that the issues of fact are resolved by preponderance of the evidence, and special issues requiring a higher degree of proof than preponderance of the evidence may not be submitted to a jury.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court's kind of helped us out on that.
Right, Your Honor. That's obviously not an absolute. There are some exceptions made by this court and by the United States Supreme Court.
So the question really becomes more where to draw the line.
Where to draw the line, absolutely, Your Honor. Third, the court would have to abandon a sensible approach used by this very court only 3 years ago to resolve the identical issue in a similar situation. Fourth, the court would have to establish for the first time in the state of Texas, for the first time, not to continue to encourage, but for the first time in the state of Texas and evidently anywhere in the United States, that the burden of proof in a case of malicious prosecution is clear and convincing.
Let me ask you about that. Have you done some 50-state search, or what is the basis for your statement that...
Your Honor, I've done a 50-state search based on computer analysis.
You can find no other state that requires an alteration of the traditional burden of the preponderance standard in malicious prosecution?
In malicious prosecution cases, no, sir. Found none.
Are there any treatise articles that you came across that deal with that subject?
No, sir. Fifth, this court would have to elevate the defenses to the tort of malicious prosecution to constitutional dimensions. And sixth, this court in this case would have to endorse a method of submission of malicious prosecution that's inherently confusing for the jury, one that has the burden of proof for some elements at one level and the burden of proof for some other elements at another level. The petitioner's case here is based fundamentally upon one case, Walmart versus Medina out of the Corpus Christi Court. The court in Walmart said the burden of proof is higher in malicious prosecution cases than for other civil cases. That statement was dictum, that statement was wrong, and that statement was unsupported by the authorities that were cited by the Corpus Christi Court. It has not stopped the Corpus Christi Court, however, from citing itself in two subsequent cases where it gratuitously said, one of them being the BFI versus Legal case, and the other one being BFI versus Zavaleta, one of those cases, I believe, the Leak case is before this court decision. In both of those cases, the Corpus Christi Court went on to suggest that the burden of proof in a malicious prosecution case is higher. It was, however, in Medina, dictum that a first-year law student could have recognized as dictum. First of all, the court in Walmart expressly said that it was declining to express an opinion on the malicious prosecution issue submitted. Secondly, Walmart itself was submitted properly on a preponderance of the evidence standard. The jury did not find malicious prosecution under that standard. And yet Walmart, in appealing a gross negligence finding, could not have predicated a proper point of error on the lower standard of proof. The Walmart law was also incorrect. Andrews versus Dewberry is the case Justice Doggett referred to, which the Fort Worth Court of Appeals specifically looked at the issue, whether it was error on the part of the trial court in submitting the issues to the jury on the preponderance of the evidence instead of submitting issues on evidence that was clear and convincing. And the court clearly there overruled any point of error predicated on that. No case can be found, none has been cited, in which malicious prosecution has been submitted on a clear and convincing evidence burden of proof. Not in Texas, not in any other state, not even in the two latest malicious prosecution cases to come to reach the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals. Both of those cases came up after Walmart versus Medina, and in both of those cases they were submitted on a preponderance of the evidence, and in neither of those cases was any objection made to the preponderance of the evidence. And finally, if you read the authority support quoted by Walmart versus Medina, the statement in the case is unsupported by those authorities. Walmart cites only one case, Diamond Shamrock versus Ortiz. Diamond Shamrock versus Ortiz is a case decided on a no evidence point. It also is a case that says only that the proof must be positive, clear, and satisfying. This is very similar to the instance in which Chief Justice Phillips in Rhodes versus Cahill stated in a case involving a burden of proof on limitations that it was a preponderance of the evidence, notwithstanding some decisions, even of this court, that indicated the proof must be clear and satisfactory. And Mr. Chief Justice Phillips observed, this is but an admonition to exercise great caution in weighing the evidence and does not supplant the usual standard of proof by preponderance of the evidence.
What does that mean?
Pardon me?
What does that mean, that an appellate court is supposed to exercise great caution in reviewing the evidence? Isn't that what they're supposed to do? We're supposed to do?
Once you certainly hope so, Your Honor, it is clear that the jurisprudence in this area, the language clear and satisfactory, clear and convincing, these terminologies are thrown recklessly throughout the cases in both at the trial level and at the appellate level, at least trial review and appellate review.
Do they have any meaning?
Well, Your Honor,
context,
I think
if you're right and there is no enhanced standards of burden of proof, what are all those statements?
It seems to me, Your Honor, that what it means is that the court might require in certain instances, and these are usually used in cases such as fraud or in the malicious prosecution area where there are strong public policies at work, the court is being admonished to make sure that the evidence is of a more direct nature and not as circumstantial or inferential as it might be, so that the more attenuated proof that might suffice in other instances should be carefully scrutinized.
So really the court's kind of talking to itself, saying we better be careful in these kinds of cases?
Your Honor, I think that's what Mr. Justice Bill said. That's what the other cases said. It's really an admonition, a warning to ourselves to look carefully at the evidence in these cases. But it does not and has not changed the actual burden of proof.
While there are old cases that emphasize the preponderance of the evidence standard, as your opposing counsel has noted, and all of us are aware, there clearly is an increase in crime and a concern that it be reported. And by the very presence of some of these cases on the books, it's clear that some malicious prosecution cases are successful. What is there, if anything, within the definition or the elements of the cause of action, malicious prosecution, that's going to be compatible with the interest of society in seeing that crimes are reported?
Thank you, Your Honor. Malicious prosecution has never been a favored cause of action. That statement can be found throughout the law from the beginning. It's never been favored because it balances two very important societal interests: the interest in efficient enforcement of criminal laws and the protection or the interest of an individual citizen to be protected from unjustifiable or oppressive litigation of a criminal nature. This balance has been weighed against the plaintiff for almost 350 years in American jurisprudence, in English jurisprudence, and more than 150 years in Texas. A plaintiff has to show malice. A plaintiff has to show want of probable cause. Plaintiff has to show that he was innocent of the charges that were actually brought. These are heavy burdens. They've always been heavy burdens. And I can tell you it's not easy to win a malicious prosecution case. And the fact that some people do may be a fact that is evidence that some people go beyond the bounds that society will accept. There is no need to raise an additional barrier because the fundamental interests have not changed. Society still needs a and efficient enforcement of criminal law. But the reputation of an innocent citizen can be, as it was here, forever sullied by a front page article about an indictment, a 6 o'clock news article about an indictment, and nary a word later on when that indictment is quashed. If we change the burden of proof in malicious prosecution, where do we stop? Does this justify...
This is not a suit against the newspaper or the television station. This is a suit against the debtor to whom the debt was owed and was not paid, and who was entitled to the collateral and who could not get it. Isn't that true?
That's correct, sir.
Coming, since you've moved to that, why isn't probable cause shown here almost as a matter of law, if not as a matter of law, by 3233C of the Penal Code?
Your Honor,
the Court of Appeals didn't discuss it.
Right, Your Honor. That section of the Penal Code specifically addresses the question of intent. There was no removal, destruction, concealment of the collateral in this case, and there was no evidence that there was any such actual criminal act.
But that intent, now, it doesn't have to. That intent is presumed.
Your Honor, the intent may be presumed from certain acts, but the intent is by itself not important if the criminal act itself doesn't take place. And there was no evidence that the criminal act took place, number one, plus whatever presumption of intent might be created by the statute was clearly rebutted by the evidence in this case. So that there simply was no probable cause on the part of the defendants in this case to take this case to the grand jury. They knew when they went to the grand jury that the only thing that had happened is that Mr. Keever had not brought in the collateral when they requested it. And that is not a crime, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said that, and the Attorney General had said that, and they're both annotated directly under that statute. No matter what presumption of intent might arise from the statute, there was no crime.
It's not concealing it or removing it to just keep it in your house or business or wherever and not give it to anybody when they ask for it over and over again.
No, that's precisely what the Court of Criminal Appeals said is not a crime of hindering secured credit.
If you remove it from the premises where it was originally and take it to some other premises and in the process don't respond to their request to return it, that removal to another premises?
No, Your Honor. Removal is also a defined term in the statute, and removal means to take it out of the county or out of the state. Removal does not mean simply to move it from one place to another.
So I as a citizen am responsible when I try to recover my collateral and somebody has moved it from where it was and I go to the DA and say, look, I'm trying to get it back, he hasn't gotten it. I'm responsible if I just goof on what I understand the elements of the crime to be.
Well, Your Honor, if you maliciously undertake without any probable cause to institute a criminal procedure, then yes, malicious prosecution lies for the plaintiff.
And I run the risk if I goof on what I understand the elements of crime.
An innocent mistake would not be actionable. It requires willful, malicious actions.
What is the evidence of malice against all of the defendants here? Let's start with Harris.
All right. Your Honor, Mr. Harris, at the time that the grand jury met, was in charge of and knew, was responsible for the institution of the criminal process, taking it to the grand jury. He was the decision maker. He knew and only knew that Mr. Keever had not returned the collateral, that Mr. Keever had not paid the debt. He did not know anything beyond that, and yet he permitted his agents to take the case to the grand jury, and at the grand jury it's pretty clear from the testimony at the trial that the jury was justified in believing that the grand jury was told at least three important lies.
By Mr. Harris?
Not by Mr. Harris.
Well, under Mr. this Harris, standard, it seems to me that the president of IBM or AT&T or virtually anybody who has a subordinate who believes they detect a crime becomes the absolute guarantor of every word spoken by that subordinate. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, he knew that they were taking it to a criminal grand jury.
Whatever person approves that, up a chain of command.
That's right, Your Honor. I don't think that it can be...
It becomes the guarantor of whatever their subordinate says. In other words, if they don't go out and investigate every bit of it themselves again, then they stand to be liable for substantial damages.
Well, certainly they may, Your Honor, under traditional standards of respondeat superior or other doctrines. It is clear...
Well, respondeat superior has gone to a corporation. Has it gone to the officers of a corporation before? In other words,
Your Honor,
we said IBM may be liable for what its subordinate does. Have we previously said the chairman of IBM may be liable?
Your Honor, I believe Ronnie respondeat superior is a theory of agency law and can apply to any principle in agency in that context, and I believe that it does in this case also.
So, to put it plainly, if you are in a decision-making capacity in an organization and someone under your control comes to you and says, I think a crime has been committed, and I'd like to go tell the grand jury. If that person is mistaken about that, then you could be liable for malicious prosecution.
Your Honor, I wonder if mistake is enough. In other words, if that person, let's say wrong, and that person intentionally uses the criminal process for an improper purpose. Mr. Harris himself said that he was using the criminal process to collect a debt. A debt that was discharged by bankruptcy. He also...
The bank was not entitled to the collateral.
No, Your Honor, the bank may have been under certain circumstances entitled to collateral, well, but they were not entitled to collect the debt.
In these circumstances, was the bank entitled to collateral?
Ultimately, yes. Not at all times. Relevant times, though, because at some relevant times, Mr. Kiever was in bankruptcy, and the bank would have had to lift the automatic stay to get the... To get the goods, but they had...
There was some indication that there was never any dispute between Mr. Kiever and the bank that the bank was entitled to the collateral.
No, I don't think it was never, Your Honor. When he's in bankruptcy, the bank has an obligation to use the bankruptcy statute. They have to get this automatic stay lifted before they can get their goods. They're entitled to them, but they have to do that. He was not in bankruptcy during all this period of time, obviously. So... after the bankruptcy was over, the debt was discharged, the bank was entitled to the goods, and as soon as the bank asked for the goods, Mr. Kiever made the goods available, the bank picked them up.
In that regard, was there any testimony from the district attorney concerning the degree of disclosure to the grand jury from these individuals about the bankruptcy?
Your Honor, yes. The district attorney's testimony was that she had not learned of the bankruptcy until after the grand jury appearance by the defendants in this case, and she was present when they testified, and she said that she learned about the bankruptcy only later. They testified that they had disclosed the bankruptcy to the grand jury. They also testified as to a couple of other things which third parties failed to corroborate or actually contradicted in every instance.
But your statement, as I understood it, was the first time the bank asked for the collateral that it was entitled to it, Mr. Kiever gave it to it. I thought that was just your statement.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. The problem will be, as Mr. Justice Phillips has noted, if the court decides to change the law here, the problem will be where do you draw the line? The United States Supreme...
Well, I want to get back. We spent a lot of time on the burden of proof. I want to get back to the fact of these cases for just a minute. I want to make sure I understand that the doctrine of respondeat superior no longer just goes to a corporation as an entity being responsible for its subordinates. There are within a corporate structure now going to be lots of agency lines as based on who reports to who that can make some one employee of a corporation can be liable for the acts of another employee of the corporation due to, shall we say, parallel agency lines that a court of law may find within that structure.
Right, Your Honor, I believe that to be so. And let me focus a little bit, if I may, on this issue as it is before this court. Because as the court knows, what we are looking at here is the review of the factual sufficiency findings of the Court of Appeals. And the question, two basic questions are raised by the petitioners here. First of all, did the court address in any way whatsoever the factual sufficiency of questions? And I think that is clear because the court defined the term Ellis Bank to include all of these defendants and then went on to say that the record contains evidence on which the jury could determine that the Ellis Bank withheld material information and presented false testimony to the grand jury. After reviewing the record, we find Ellis Bank's lack of evidence contention without merit. After considering and weighing all evidence, no facts suggest that the jury could not have also inferred from the evidence addressed at trial that Ellis Bank acted with malice in instituting criminal charges against Kiefer. So it's clear that the court did address it. The next question becomes, did the court sufficiently set them forth for this court to be able to tell whether or not it applied the proper standard? And in that regard, petitioners referred to Poole versus Ford Motor Company. I would suggest to the court that Poole versus Ford Motor Company does not require an enhanced factual presentation by the Court of Appeals in this case, since in this case the Court of Appeals affirmed the jury findings.
Why shouldn't we extend Poole to affirmance as well as reversal so that we can see, for instance,
right,
whether or not the court applied the correct standard with regard to the individual?
Your Honor, I think there's a very important practical reason why the court should not extend it. First of all, the same constitutional questions with regard to right to trial by jury are not implicated when the Court of Appeals affirms. But more importantly, when the Court of Appeals affirms, it might be totally counterproductive to require specification in support of the jury's verdict, because then we would have a losing party, as we have here, complaining of the way the Court of Appeals writes its opinion, its distillation or specification of evidence, when the real discussion and the real decision was made on a totality of the evidence. The only way a Court of Appeals could protect itself in that instance, when it affirms, is to recite the entire trial transcript. Otherwise, it simply couldn't take a chance on leaving out a piece of evidence that affirms the jury finding. This court has never reversed an appellate court's affirmance of a jury finding for failure to specify facts in support of the jury. Perhaps it is time.
Questions?
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I was just trying to say when you're answering, you're speaking.
I think I'm through, Your Honor. Thank you. But certainly
anything
questions?
Else? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, with respect to the Poole Park point, we believe that the appellant as well as the appellee has a right to an adequate review of the evidence, that is to an appeal. That's part of your basic right to trial by jury. And the only way this court can determine whether or not the correct standard of review was applied by the Court of Appeals is if there is a review of the evidence. And that right should be afforded to the appellant as well as the appellee. Now, second point is, was the bank entitled to the collateral at all relevant times? Key dates in this case. First off, bankruptcy was filed on May 4th, 1987, in this case, 3 days before this note was due. The bank was not listed on the schedule of creditors. The bank did not learn of the bankruptcy until October of 1987. Mr. Kiefer was discharged from bankruptcy on May 29th of 1988. The first contact with the grand jury was in October of 1988 when there was an appointment that was later rescheduled. So he was in and out of bankruptcy before there was any contact with the grand jury. The indictment was, initial indictment was issued in November. There was a second indictment issued, and it was dismissed in December of 88. Almost 2 years later, August 30th of 90, was when the bank finally received the collateral.
Which of your points of error does this argument relate to?
I'm trying, well, actually it goes to the issue of probable cause, the issue of the effect of bankruptcy.
And does that relate to a no evidence challenge or your desire to have more evidence outlined under this expansion of Poole or what?
I believe it also relates to our no evidence challenge, and that on the probable cause, one of the things that was addressed earlier was the presumption that was created by the statute. I was trying to lay the dates with respect to the bankruptcy before the court. But if you look, In fact, at the section 32.33 of the Penal Code, subsection C creates a presumption, and there's two facts that must be present before the presumption is created. One is that there's a failure of the part of the debtor to pay the debt when due, which is uncontested in this case. No question, Mr. Keever didn't pay the debt on May 7th or any time thereafter. And second point is, if the secured party makes demand to deliver possession of the secured property to the secured party, and there's no question, I believe it's exhibit number two, there was demand made by the bank for delivery of the security, and it was not delivered. So under subsection C of article, or section 32.33, there is a presumption created. There is a presumption of intent to hinder the creditor. And we believe that this presumption alone should be sufficient to establish proximate cause. Probable cause. That if indeed there's a presumption that's created by the statute, then probable cause exists to go to the grand jury. Otherwise, the legislature would not have put the presumption into the statute. Third, with respect to the malice findings, with respect to Mr. Harris, with respect to the other players who were involved in this case, it's important to note that the person that they consulted, in this case, Mr. Hastings, who was the attorney, was an ex-district attorney himself. They went to someone who was an ex-district attorney for advice. And he, again, advised them to go to the grand jury, and they followed his advice. And we believe that, again, there is just no evidence in this record of any malice on the part of the defendants. We believe the evidence is, there is some conflicting evidence, but it's undisputed the bank didn't get the collateral despite repeated demands from the plaintiff in this case until almost 2 or 3 years after the note was due. It took them that long to actually go out and to receive the collateral. Finally, very briefly with respect to the issue of clear and convincing, the Walmart, as far as it was being dicta, we would take opposition with that point because in Walmart, one of the things that the plaintiff was trying to do in that case was to recover on a negligence theory. And the court in that case said, no, the Supreme Court and other courts have created such a body of law that affords all these protections to the defendant that we're not going to allow you to circumvent all these protections afforded to these defendants by going to a negligence theory. And they said, you cannot recover on a negligence theory. So we believe to the extent that it was encompassed in the embodiment of law that was addressed by the Court of Appeals, that it is not dicta and that it is relevant. And finally, again, as Mr. Wood has confessed, if it does not meet either standard review or standard of proof, then we have numerous cases from the Courts of Appeals and from this court making these pronouncements, which basically are meaningless. The courts are instructing themselves with language that doesn't mean anything.
From reviewing your brief, I see that there are some cases from other jurisdictions here on bankruptcy points. Is opposing counsel correct that there are no other states that have adopted a clear and convincing standard for malicious prosecution actions?
I have not checked that point, but again, I think even if you were to check that, one of the things that you would have to look is to see whether or not the particular state had built in other protections for the defendants besides merely just the enhanced burden of proof. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Judge, please rise.